Welcome, everyone. This is the third call in a series that Ron Baker has led on value pricing, and it's one of the final discussions we're going to do in the Graduate Network on this for a while. And I think the question that we're all looking at, and at least that I know Ron and our other guest speaker, Chris, are looking at, is how do we put an end to the billable hour? And, you know, Ron's mission, he would say it's once and for all, how do we bury the billable hour in the professions? So how do we eliminate the billable hour, take better care of our clients, and be more profitable than we were using the billable hour? And I think that everyone on this call knows that the discussion about the value pricing has been going on for a long time in this profession. And I think some of the speakers on this call would say that we've been giving it a lot of good lip service, but not doing a lot about it over the last couple of decades. So our speakers today are committed to putting an end to the billable hour and making value pricing a reality. So let me take a minute to introduce them, and then I just want to say a few things about, I want to make sure we introduce the graduate to our speakers. Ron Baker, most of you know, Ron's one of the most popular speakers we've had on the Graduate Network calls. He graduated from San Francisco State University with a Bachelor of Science in Accounting and a minor in Economics. He started his accounting career in 1984 with KPMG. He was a private business service, advisor in San Francisco. He is also, in addition to be a frequent speaker around the country, he is the author of best-selling marketing book, and he, actually the Professional Guide to Value Pricing, I think, is one of the bestsellers for the ABA. Is it with the ABA, Ron?
No, it's actually CCH.
Oh, CCH, okay. And the book has been ranked number one on Amazon.com in Australia and New Zealand. He's also written Burying the Billable Hour, Trashing the Timesheet, and you are Your Customer List. So he's got a number of other articles and books out there. And, you know, that we could go on with Ron for quite a while. Also on the call with us is Chris Marston. And Chris is actually been working on the billable hour for quite, I mean, the value pricing for quite a while. He has earned a Bachelor of Business degree and a finance degree from Northeastern University in Boston, a great university, by the way, Chris. He also earned a JD and an MSF, Master's of Science in Finance from Suffolk University in Boston, Mass. So, before I turn the call over to Ron and Chris, Ron, I know that you're familiar with a lot of the graduates, but Chris, let me just quickly introduce to you, the graduates. Most of the people on this call are graduates of an Atticus program, and one of the things they've committed to is to re-engineer their practice so that it serves their clients' lives better. It can increase their revenues and their personal income while decreasing their stress and their hours. And so they're very entrepreneurial. The people you're talking to on this call are very entrepreneurial, but many of them have been struggling with this issue of value pricing, and you'll hear people on this call like Jack Ross and Lonnie and Mark Chin. They've been working on it for a while, but there's still questions, and especially some of the litigators have questions on this. So as we get into this call, maybe we could address how it's good for the litigator, how it can work for the litigators.
Right.
And one last thing, before I turn this over, I'd like the participants to write down this date. If you would, write down January 25th and 26th. Both Ron and Chris are facilitating a private session for 15 attorneys, and they're going to lead them through a very specific process of how to finally create the value pricing in your own firm. And there'll be a group of litigators, family law, and different practices in there. And I know Lonnie's going to be there, Mark Chin, and a few others. So I know a number of you on this call are already registered for this program. If you're not able to get into it, because it's obviously very limited, make sure you pay a lot of attention to this call. Go back and listen to some of Ron's past calls, buy his book, because that's going to make an enormous difference. So that's January 25th and 26th. It's going to be in Orlando, so those people from New York and Boston that want to get out of the cold, come on down to Orlando for a while. So with that, Ron and Chris, I'm going to turn it over to you. And, Ron, perhaps you could do a quick recap, if that's possible, of some of the core issues around value pricing that we've talked about on the past calls, and perhaps how it benefits the shareholders in a law firm, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. I mean, I know a lot of people have heard me before, so I'm not going to dive back into the theory, but just so you know, we the problem with the billable hour is, of course, it makes attorneys think they sell time. And there's not a client out there that buys time. People don't buy efforts. I don't buy my plumber's time. I buy what he can do for me. And so what we think you're really selling is intellectual capital. You're selling your knowledge, your wisdom, your experience, your professional judgment. And there is no standard price on that. And one of the problems with the billable hour is it caps our income. You know, if you want to make $1 million, you have to bill 1 million hours. And if you want to make more, you have to bill more. And there's only so much humans can do. It's not a very good leverageable model if you compare it to other intellectual capital enterprises like Microsoft or, you know, J.K. Rowling's with Harry Potter. So we think you're selling intellectual capital. And what that means is there's really no standard price on intellectual capital. It should be priced based upon the value that it delivers to the client. And one of the confusions out there is everybody thinks that value pricing means some type of, you know, gouging the client, charging all you can, and that's just utter nonsense. For some of the things that you do, your price actually might be less because it's adding relatively little value. But for those things that you do that add enormous value, there are ways to capture that price, to capture that some of that value much more effectively than the billable hour. And we're starting to see, and as Mark said, this has been an issue that the legal profession has taken the lead on. I mean, it was the legal profession that put us into the billable hour. If you trace the history of it, and I won't do that because it sounds kind of boring, but if you trace the history of it, the billable hour did start in the legal profession. Now, it was taught to them by MBAs and cost accountants and other bean counter types, but it spread into the legal profession in the mid-1940s, and by the 1950s, it was pretty endemic. But the legal profession has also taken the lead in getting us out of it. There are three seminal books written, published by the ABA by a guy named Richard Reed, who's been attacking the billable hour since 1992. So this is an issue that's been out there. The ABA has done a lot of work on it. There's been an ABA commission report on it. Even Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer wrote the foreword to the ABA commission report, and just utterly blasted the billable hour for ruining the morale and the spirit of the legal profession. And if any of you are familiar with the blogosphere out there, Chris maintains a blog, I maintain a blog, and of course, from what I hear, 20% of blogs are legal blogs. I guess lawyers love to write. You'll see all sorts of information out there and talk about the billable hour. Scott Turow just wrote an article in the ABA Journal about why the billable hour is not ethical and the other problems with it. There is now another law firm that we know about right in Chris's backyard in Boston, the Shepherd Law Group. It's an employment law firm that has completely ridded themselves of the billable hour and the timesheet. So this notion that it can't be done, that it can't be done in litigation, that it can't be done in this practice or this sector of law, is utterly spurious now. We've got firms around the world who have done it. So the question is, how are they doing it? What have they learned? Of course they've made mistakes. I think about all the mistakes that we're making with the billable hour. One of the questions that we ask all participants in our program is, we like you to think about how much money is being left on the table if you're not charging for value and if you're simply selling time. The fact of the matter is, lawyers aren't union employees, you know, so an hourly rate shouldn't matter to you. You're knowledge workers, you're selling intellectual capital and experience, and what matters is the value of those ideas to your client. And I think the reason some of you that are doing this are struggling with it, and that's music to my ears. I want you to struggle with this. You're struggling with it because there is no formula for it. I can't give you a formula for value because value is subjective. If I'm in the desert and I'm dehydrated, a bottle of Evian water is priceless to me. I'd pay anything for it to stay alive. But if I'm washing my dog with the same quantity of water, it's going to be far less valuable to me. And if I'm standing in my basement and it's flooding with water, then the water's actually got a negative value because now I'm going to have to pay to have it removed. Your job as an attorney is to figure out where your client is. Are they in the desert or are they in the basement? And your first job is to put a value on the service. It's kind of, and I'm going to give you something that we just think is fantastic. This is the McKinsey approach to getting at value. The first thing McKinsey consulting firm will say to a client is, we won't even work with you unless we can prove that our value delivered is at least 3 or 4 times our price. Now, that's a fantastic way to start a discussion because it starts out talking about value. You're not talking about hours. You're not talking about inputs and costs. You're talking about value. And the only way to set a value price is to get some understanding of the client's value and then work backwards to price. And that allows you to work backwards to cost. So many people get hung up on this fact that there's no timesheet. How would you know if you were profitable? Well, you know it because the price drives the cost, not the other way around. The only way you take on a job is if the price covers its expected costs, which forces us basically to do the cost accounting and, in effect, the timesheet before we do the work. The other thing I'd say, and then maybe I'll introduce Chris, is the other beauty about value pricing, especially if you combine it with a service guarantee, and Chris's firm does this, a 100% unconditional money-back guarantee, the client's not satisfied. They get to pay only what they thought it was worth. Now, of course, we're not advocating this based upon some type of contingent outcome. You're not saying that you're going to win the case, or you're not predicating it based on an outcome. You're predicating it based upon the service, the relationship working with your firm. And because of that service guarantee, you're going to be able to charge a premium price because it lowers the risk to the client. The other nice thing about value pricing is it puts a price on the service and a value when the client needs the service the most. When, in other words, when they're least price sensitive. A service is always more valuable when it's needed than after it's been delivered. And one of the reasons the professions write down more than they write up is because they tend to price after the service has been delivered. Well, we can't manage value retroactively. So a client looks at your bill and says, wow, you know, why did it cost so much? Why didn't you tell me? Well, we think it's far smarter for firms to know that the client didn't like the price before you do the work. It doesn't do any good after. And it certainly doesn't do any good to know your cost to the penny after if the client doesn't like your price. Hence, this is one of the problems with timesheets. So all of those things combined, I know it sounds daunting. I know it goes against 50, 60 years of conventional wisdom of practicing law. But the fact of the matter is this is how every other business prices. When especially litigators, and I'm not picking on you, but I just want you to think about this, when litigators say, oh, we can't do this in litigation, there's way too many variables, we don't know what the other side's going to do, the judge, all of these things, I just want you to think about how actuaries price earthquake insurance. We just had an earthquake out here in Southern California, or in San Jose, Silicon Valley, and I've got earthquake insurance on my house, and my insurance company doesn't know when the next quake is going to strike, how big it's going to be, what the costs are going to be, how much they're going to have to pay out, but you know what? They give me a fixed price. And we as consumers and business people demand fixed prices. We demand to know the price before we buy. So it's actually the sectors that use the billable hour are actually trying to defy the laws of economics. And it's not working very well, and that's why everybody's so dissatisfied with the status quo. And that's why it's so refreshing to have guys like Chris Marston out there with Exemplar Law, Shepherd Law Group, that are out there doing alternatively, and we've got accounting firms doing this, we've got ad agencies doing this, we work in across the professional knowledge sector, and there are firms out there that are not pricing by the hour, that don't keep timesheets, and this works. The clients love it. The people that work for the firm love it. It makes for a happier internal morale, because I think it gives you a sense of self-respect. You're not selling your time. You're selling your intellectual capital, and we think there's great nobility in being paid for the value that you create. So with that, I just want to make a brief introduction to Chris, and I'll let him make some remarks about this, because I found Chris through basically the Internet when I saw the press release on his business launch, and he started talking about no more hourly bull. You know, we don't bill by the hour. We give a complete service guarantee, and I'm looking at this website going, wow, this guy, he's doing everything that I've been writing about for years. So I sent Chris an email, and he kind of wrote me back, and he said, wow, he said, you know, your book, Firm of the Future, is kind of our business model, where we got a lot of our ideas from. And so Chris and I struck up a friendship. I flew out to Boston. We had dinner. I've worked with this guy. I think he's brilliant. I think he's 31 years old, which tells you that innovation is usually a young person's arena. But with that, here's Chris Marston, folks, and I'll let him explain to you his vision for Exemplar and the legal profession as a whole.
Thanks, Ron. Humbling description. I am 31. And yeah, my background, I just come from a deep business background. I was a chief financial officer for a technology company for a couple of years. I was on the consumer side of legal services, from intellectual property to corporate, and really just saw how frustrating it is, because CFOs, I mean, we're happy to pay and pay dearly, but we want to pay for value, and we need to be able to budget. And after law and business school, just recognized that everybody in practice, in corporate practice at least, was miserable. There wasn't a single person I know who was in a corporate firm who could cite that they were happy, and those who pretended to be only cited money and as an example, and that was all they had to say, and we all know better than that. What was profound to me, and the reason I really connect with the word, and Mark used re-engineering, it really is what we're doing, is re-engineering the practice of law, because I was struck by how impactful changing your business model can be to the way that people are treated in this profession, the way people are valued, people's lives and careers and where they go, and how people develop. And what I see in our industry is a significant deterioration in morale, professional satisfaction, high attrition rates, divorce, alcoholism, you name it. Women are leaving the profession twice the rate of men. There are significant human capital problems that need to be solved. And I truly have seen and believe and am passionate about the connection between the way we do business as a profession and the solution to these problems. And that solution has been linked to the pricing model. So I describe the pricing model as domino one. But, you know, obviously it takes, our business model takes aim at not only pricing, but also the compensation model of a traditional law firm, which also puts the incentives in the wrong place. So what value pricing does, it aligns the incentives. It really is much the same with your people, is looking at where are your incentives. We started out as the first full-service corporate law firm in the nation that does not bill by the hour. We've abandoned that model. We will not do it. We won't do it. We are entirely on the subjective theory of value, which is value pricing. We have backed that up with a 100% satisfaction guarantee. It's prominently featured on the website. And in hundreds and hundreds of instances, we have not had a single client, and I'm knocking on something that's like wood, but it's probably press board. You know, we have not had a single instance where somebody has taken us up on this. And that has been a great confirmation of what it is that we stand for, and also good client selection and other practices, that it takes discipline to implement. But, you know, I'd like to congratulate everyone on the call who's trying. If you're all here, you're here because you're trying, and congratulations. It's not, there is no formula. No one will give you the answer, but there are great ideas and great ways, and reengineering is what it's about. And if you're dedicated to it, there's definitely a way.
Thanks, Chris. Ron, I'm going to see if you, is there anything you want to bat around with Chris before we go into a couple of questions?
No, yes, I would. That'd be great. Chris, you know, I get a lot of questions from the litigators out there who always say, geez, you know, there's no way that litigators can give a value price. How does your firm handle that when it's confronted with a litigation pricing issue?
Sure. I get that question a lot, too, Ron. I usually draw a picture here, but if you can envision a small circle, that's work you know is guaranteed to happen. In a litigation, there's certain work that's guaranteed to happen. Then you draw a little bigger circle with the smaller one in the center of it. Now, that is work that is likely to happen. You're likely to take certain depositions, or you're likely to need to do a certain amount of discovery, or even do a motion to dismiss, or a summary judgment motion. And then there's a bigger circle that encompasses everything. And that's the circle I call, who the hell knows? And that's where people have the most problems with. And the easiest way to look at it, and I'm a 3,000-foot kind of guy, we can go in from there, but you've got to understand it from a 3,000-foot level. If anybody's in a downtown area right now, look out your window. There's high-rise buildings everywhere. Who owns that? Insurance companies own that. So what do you think you're selling them? At some point, if people want peace of mind, you realize, because in our daily lives, we all pay dearly for it, that they're really buying peace of mind. They're buying an insurance policy. And those insurance policies are what finance the ownership of the high-rise buildings around this country. There's not a single law firm that I know of that owns those buildings. So, I mean, it really is, it's getting to understand what exactly is the customer buying. It really is, it's psychological, it's emotional. And if you understand what they're buying, then you could price it, but you have to price it based on value. But there's also the staging issue. So what we do recommend to litigators, and we do it ourselves, is you can stage out a litigation. If you've got companies with unlimited budgets, they would be happy to pay, like huge companies, quite well and quite dearly for an insurance policy. And you can work out reverse contingency fees and clever reverse contingencies with kickers for ending the litigation earlier in time if you set up the value proposition properly. Oftentimes we just stage the litigation out and define it with a goal of trying to get it resolved within a certain point and have a very handsome incentive for it. So being anti-billable hour does not mean being just fixed price. It is pricing based on value, and it is pricing by putting your incentives in the right place with the client. Clients certainly don't want a litigation to go on forever. People lose sleep over this stuff. They want it to get done faster.
So
you pay more for a direct flight than you do a connecting flight. It really is the same thing. So we stage it out and scope it. You know, I scope it out. Even in an early stage, you're still going to have the three circles of, you know, yes, it's going to happen, maybe, or who the hell knows. And you've just got to price that appropriately.
So your approach is really to align the economic interests of your firm and the clients.
Yeah, and they're happy to tell you. It's not a mystery where their interests are.
That's right. Chris, how do you handle clients who just tell you they absolutely refuse to be priced on any other method other than the billable hour? What would be your response?
I'm sorry, what ask the question once more?
What would be your response to a client who approached your firm and said, I refuse to be priced on any other method other than the billable hour? In other words, I want to see your timesheets. I want to see your hours.
Oh, that's great. Well, those are two separate questions. The first one is somebody who comes and wants to be billed by the hour, and we do our competition a favor, and we send them down the street.
Beautiful.
I'm not going to spend my life counting. You know, imagine that. It's so funny because we're a profession that's got such high egos and high requirements for autonomy, and yet we let our clients run our businesses for us. I mean, literally, they tell you how to live your life, because if they demanded me to count my time, then I would have to go through my entire professional life counting in 6-minute increments for them.
Right.
Are you kidding me? We won't do it. We'll send them down the street, because ultimately what they do after a year or two is get burned somehow, because our industry is notorious for absolutely poor project management. So they'll give them a budget and then go over the budget by 3 or 4 times. I've heard as much as 10, but anyways. And they'll ultimately come back, and then they'll demand to do business on a fixed price and will never change, would never go back.
Right.
The other one, Ron, is a situation where, you know, a client demands to see the time, you know, the counting of time, and we don't do that either.
Right.
And I know that the litigators have probably got several questions around how you account for legal fees in a court when they account in a judgment for attorney's fees. Maybe I'll wait for that question to come up.
Mark, let's open it up to questions.
Well, I'm gonna suggest if you can, because one of the things that'll happen, Chris and Ron, when we open up, you'll hear some noise in the background because
Sure. Sometimes
we're not on mute. So, that question comes up a lot. the one that you just addressed, Chris. The fact that how do you deal with this when your fees are contested and you have to back up your fees that you've charged? And I hear a lot of family law attorneys say that, especially, and some litigators. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, very good question. And part of it is training the courts, first of all. And you know, I hate to say it, but the late leaders, just as we're the leaders and we have to educate customers, we have to educate the courts on how we operate and how, you know, that how we track our efforts or our time that we put in. That doesn't mean we don't spend time. That doesn't mean that we couldn't go back and say that, first of all, Your Honor, a judge, we don't operate on that model. We price based on value. But here is the amount of resources expended. Here were the outcomes. Here were the documents produced in this case. And whether or not they were itemized and they're real time to the minute or in a 3,000-foot level, ultimately it's going to come down to, does the judge think it's reasonable anyways? How are they going to value your time? Never the way you do. But I haven't heard yet a situation where they've just dismissed it altogether because you don't keep time records in its finite sense, you know, in 6-minute increments. So if you had to go back and estimate how much resources you put into it, you probably have to do that to prove to a court. But that's not to say that there's not risk in it. There is risk in it. You have to educate the courts to understand what you do and value it.
And the guys that have been experimenting with it, Mark Chin, who's unfortunately not able to be on this call, has done really brilliant work in this area from a matrimonial practice. And his profit margins have gone up dramatically. As a matter of fact, we do a program where the attorneys are challenge themselves to double their revenues in a certain amount of time.
Great.
And what it does is it forces them to get out of their box and look at the practice differently. But one of the things that a number of matrimonial attorneys and litigators have done is they've looked at the the value pricing as part of this process. It's not the only thing, but part of the process in doubling their revenues. And I think if Mark was on the call, he would say it's one of those things that made an enormous difference and it affected his profitability dramatically. And, you know, he hasn't been very concerned with the hourly fees being contested in court for a couple of reasons. Number one, it rarely ever happens. And when he does, he figures he'll just have to go back and account as best he can there. And I just want to say something else to everyone on the call, what Ron and Chris are advocating here. I don't think that it's an option much longer, that most of you on this call tend to be the leading edge in many ways in your practices. If you're on this call, you tend to be that way anyways. But this is one of those places that we're going to have to be uncomfortable and sort of edge in. Just if you look at this practice, and I think everyone on this call knows these numbers. In 1968, Chris, you probably know these numbers. We had 168,000 licensed lawyers in this country. By 1980, that number had grown to 860,000. Year 2000, we went over 1 million. We're about 1.24, I think the number is right now. We're graduating 43,000 students every single year, up from 36,000 students a few years back. There's no cap on this profession as far as the number of people you can allow into it. So the supply is continually growing. In my home state of Florida, there's one attorney for every 260 Floridians, man, woman, and child. I think in the United States, it's one for every 340 Americans, man, woman, and child. And so the supply continues to grow. And what that means from an economic principle is we have excess supply. And any time, any market, whether it's attorneys, doctors, CPAs, or the trades, any time we have excess supply, the customers take control. And the customers start making demands on how they want to see things. Years ago, you could truly expect the loyalty of your customer, your client, and it's not so anymore. I think most of you on this call that have been participating in this kind of work for a while see that the re-engineering, this kind of value pricing entering into the picture, we really don't have an option but to start experimenting now before it swamps us and before the innovators get to it before we do. So let's do that, Ron. Let's open up the call. I'm going to ask everyone, if the call is too noisy, I'm just going to ask you to check your mute button and make sure that we are muted. So, Susan, are you on with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Do you want to put it into the conference, open conference?
Okay, let's do it.
See what happens. So we may be in open conference now. I just want to check. Lonnie, are you on the call?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, Lonnie.
Okay, Lonnie, I'm here.
Lonnie, I'm just curious. You've been experimenting with value pricing. Can you talk a little bit about what you've worked with and any struggles that you've had with it?
Well, the struggles are, and I was going to ask Ron and Chris this, because this comes up all the time. When I talk to other lawyers about the concept of value pricing, the first thing people hear is that we're going to bill more, we're going to charge people more money. Now, I know the core of this is the value to the client, okay, and I get that, but how do you explain to people that what we're trying to do is we're trying, by value billing, we're not saying that we're going to charge more money necessarily, but that we're going to bill in a different way so that the client gets better value. How do you explain that to people who are in the mode of hourly billing?
Well, I'll jump on that, and then I'll let Chris answer it. My response to that is we are doing this to align, just like Chris explained, the economic incentives between the client and the lawyer. Since the client's not buying our time, they should only pay for what they value. That might mean that we can settle the case more, you know, efficaciously if we went into arbitration or some other method. In other words, it's not just about billing hours. It's about solving their legal needs in the most efficacious manner. And I use that word efficacious because it's a special word. It means that you have some type of magical power, you know, that allows you to do what you do. There's more of an art to it. And the other thing that value pricing does is it takes away risk from the client. So this is why clients flock to firms that give them alternatives, because if I remove risk from the client, then the client's going to be willing to pay me a price premium, just like we do with our mortgages. Most of us go for fixed-rate mortgages because we don't want to ride the roller coaster risk. Well, it's the same with the price. If I give you a client a fixed price up front, they're willing to pay me a premium. So it's not just about charging a higher price. It's about aligning the economic incentives and pricing commensurate with the value.
They're talking, but it's
irrespective of the time it takes.
You know what I mean?
Whoever said, you know what I mean, just check your mute button. It's not muted.
No, that's okay. I don't want to ask any questions.
Whoever said I don't want to ask any questions, your phone was not muted, just so you know. Chris, did you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, sure. I'll be quick on this one. I learned early on to focus. You know, it's funny. My question, sometimes I answer a question with a question, is why the heck are you trying to convince an attorney who doesn't get it what it is that you do? But I learned early on that to focus, you know, the 80-20 rule, and 20% of your efforts produce 80% of the outcomes that matter to your business. And trying to get people who are value ignorant, and that's not to insult them, it's just to understand that some people don't, value pricing in subjective theory of value is not simple. It is complex, and that's why we're on this call struggling with it, and they aren't. They're not going to be able to understand a 30-second pitch on what it is. Ultimately, they're going to try and nail you down like attorneys do and say, well, are you charging more ultimately or less? And they're only doing that for the purpose of either justifying that either they're going to make less money if you say yes, or if you're charging more, then they're going to think you're ripping them off because their clients already think they're ripping them off. So I don't spend too much time trying to explain it to attorneys who don't get it unless they really are patient with you explaining that there is no such thing or it's more or less, because that question in and of itself takes for granted that we are a commodity. And so we have to explain that the whole basis of the model is not just to price on value, but to also add a heck of a lot more value than any attorney already is adding.
You know, one of the other things that I like, and I know Lonnie is very, very good at this, and actually Lonnie is a star at doing this, is it forces you to focus more on what the client really needs and wants. From a legal perspective, and what they really value when you set the pricing. Lonnie, I'm going to ask you a question, but I'm just curious. Steve, if Steve Riley's on the phone, could you pop up and say if you're on the line? Lonnie, could you share a little bit about what you've been experimenting with value pricing so people get a sense of the sort of things you've done?
Yeah, okay. Well, we've talked about this before on some of these calls, but it was the idea of people that are coming in to see me, the intake process. Our market here is such that, and I do family law, that most family lawyers will offer a free initial consultation to sort of get the client in the door and then hopefully land them as a client. And I hated that idea because I was getting people coming in to see me and they would spend a bunch of time and then either they would not want me or whatever. And I just hated it and I just was throwing away my time. So we've instituted a process. We call it the matrimonial assessment. And what we do is we have a whole system set up now where we try to really sell the value of this system to the client before we talk to them about any pricing. And what we do is we say, you know, when somebody phones us up, they'll talk to our intake coordinator, and the intake coordinator will talk all about exactly what we provide them in terms of a service. They come in to see us. It's a consultation. They get a full, they understand the full legal issues, what the options are, all the different cost structures in terms of what to deal with this. Certainly the different options for settlement, and we give them books. We produced a DVD that we give them on how to keep the kids out of the middle of the divorce because, you know, it's an excellent DVD by a couple of psychologists and give them books and reading materials about their particular case. And we do that for a flat price, and we fix it up front. And my fee for that, for somebody just coming to see me is $2,500, and I don't, and it's not based on time. I mean, you know, they can last anywhere from an hour to, you know, 2.5 or 3 hours of time, but it's not based on time. We don't sell it on time, and so it's a flat rate system that we do up front, and it's just been fabulous. It's just been so successful, and it's worked so well in our industry, and I've been trying to get other people to do it, and it seems to be working well for them.
Ron, you know, it's an interesting question because as a lot of people struggle with this, in Lonnie's example, he got focused on value, and then he put a flat fee around that value.
Right.
Is there any problem with that when you look at value pricing? Because I know that, you know, we've used other experiments that you really look at the issue that the client is, the urgency, the crisis, those sort of things. You create a price, an individual price. From a value pricing perspective, is there any issue with what Lonnie's doing pricing-wise?
No, I've talked to Lonnie about this at length, and I like what he's doing. We're not against having some type of minimum price as a way to, say, screen clients or to get commitment from them or things like that. But ideally, once you start doing engagements, especially when you do engagements that are at the top of the value curve, ideally, from a pricing perspective, you do want to price one at a time and not, say, off of some standard price list or something like that. You want to look at all of the factors in that particular case, all of the value drivers. And this is what most businesses are turning into. I mean, Verizon Wireless, with 30 million customers, wants to ultimately price each cell phone user one at a time rather than throwing them into the buckets that they throw them into. And you got to ask yourself, well, why? Well, because then they can customize a plan just for you. Not only is it more profitable, but it also generates more loyalty from the client.
Yeah, and I imagine Lonnie would do that after the matrimonial assessment.
Yes.
Which, by the way, I love, Lonnie, what you did. He actually named his product. He productized it and named his value and outlined it right up front. Let me just see, Chris and Ron, if there are other people on the call that have questions. So if you have a question for Ron or Chris, go ahead and unmute yourself and say your city and name.
Hey, Mark, it's Tom DeMarcus.
Hey, Tom, we know what city you're from. Just from the accent. If anyone doesn't know, it's
Mark, I was hoping that Ron and Chris would be able to get into a little bit more of the nuts and bolts and the email announcing the call.
Well, when you say nuts and bolts, what precisely do you mean?
Oh, questions to ask your client before establishing a price, questions to ask yourself before establishing a price, utilizing the three prices, Gedanken, and I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Tom, you know, some of the things, I have to apologize for that, because I asked Ron to do a review, and he can go into some of that. He's actually done that on prior calls, and they're all downloadable for you, Tom. You can listen to them any time. So I apologize. I might have put too much detail in there. Because when I talked to Ron, I wanted him to do not to spend so much time in detail because he's done that on the prior calls.
but to be able to answer questions from people as well. But if you want, you can get into a, Ron, if you want to get into a little detail there, you can.
Sure. Just let me give you some real quick, and this is obviously not an exhaustive list, Tom, but I think if you talk to anybody who value prices, one of the things that we've learned doing this is it all comes down to the quality of the conversation that you have with your client. The better you understand what they're trying to achieve, the better you can tailor your services to achieve that goal, again, in the most efficacious way. So I think one of the first questions we have to establish beyond the McKinsey question that I told you about, you know, four times our price in value, is what do you expect from us? What are the client's real expectations? Now, sometimes they might not know. You're going to have to prod them. As, you know, you guys are the pros. You know that a client comes to you with some type of an issue or problem, but it's usually maybe just the tip of the iceberg. You have to dig a lot lower to get to the root cause. A lot of times they're just telling you the effect or the symptom. But like a doctor, you guys go, you know, you don't treat the fever, you treat the cause of the fever. And so I guess figuring out the client's expectations, what do you expect from us? How are you going to judge the relationship, a successful relationship with your attorney? It's another great question. In other words, how are they going to grade you? If we don't figure these things out, there is no way that we're going to know how we're doing for them as we progress on their matter. It'd be like sitting in a class and not knowing how the professor grades. You'd be totally in the dark. The other questions that we like are, especially if they're switching firms, is find out what they didn't like about the prior firm, of course. That will give you tremendous insight about what their value drivers are, but also find out what they liked about the prior firm. Even though they're changing, there are probably some things that they like. Other questions that you can ask is things like, you know, look, price wasn't an issue here. How would you like to solve this issue, or how would you like to proceed? It just kind of focuses you on the value of what you're trying to do and the ultimate outcome. So I guess defining the metrics of success. Questions that we like to have you ask yourself internally before you even quote a price to a client are things like, hey, who am I dealing with? If it's a company, you know, where are they on the org chart? If they're a CEO, are they legal counsel? Who referred this customer? If it's a warm customer referral, they're going to be less price sensitive. What are the timelines, deadlines? In other words, why are they in our office now? And who's paying for the service? Maybe they're spending other people's money, which makes them less price sensitive. Are there any competitors? Are they shopping law firms? What do you know about those competitors? You know, all of these types of questions, just take it out of this one-dimensional reality of, I'm just going to multiply my rate times my hours. There's a lot more to value than that. I hope that shed some light. There's a lot more on our website and in my free downloadable book on these questions as well.
And I don't have much more to add because it really is unique in the circumstance for me. We definitely take a look at everything from, we try to get to the root of the psychology behind it. Nobody is buying a nicely written document from a lawyer that has, you know, 150 Latin words in it. They're buying something that makes them feel better, their family better. I mean, if they're a litigation client and it's a small business, then this is keeping them up at night. Oftentimes,
there's no proof that it's just like previously.
Oftentimes, it's just about caring, and if you care, then you ask enough questions that show that you care about them, and not only you build the loyalty in that, but you learn things you wouldn't learn in a typical course of questioning, like, for instance, a client's wife, for instance, that is far more shook up about the litigation than the husband is, who owns the business, and since they live together, it definitely affects his life as well. Or even who's paying the bill. Sometimes there are other parties that'll pay the bill to keep other people out of trouble, and you've got to ask questions about, you know, their sensitivity and what they value. So I really do try and get to the root of the psychology of it. What is it that they're buying, and what emotional problem am I solving, and how much, you know, how much is that worth to them?
Well,
I just want to point out.
No fucking way. Come on.
Gang, I just want to point out, if you're in a group setting, some of you, somebody just said, no effing way. Just so you know, it's not muted.
No.
So you might want to check your mute button.
Hopefully
that out. Hey, so let me, let me see if there are other questions.
Yes, Mark, this is Jack Ross.
Go ahead,
speaking,
Jack.
And first let me thank Lonnie for his ideas. I was in on that that call as well, and Lonnie, you've made me lots of money. Thank you. But Ron and Chris, let me begin by saying, you know, I'm sold on the concept. I'm down to the how-to at this point. But one of the things I've noticed is that one of the incentives that clients have, a lot of times in litigation, clients are angry and they're emotional. And you need to get past that before you can get a resolution. And one of the ways you get past that is to talk about, you know, what it's going to cost you to go forward. Resolution of this has this value to you, then there's substantially less incentive for the client to accept less than 100% victory in order to resolve the case. It's not always the case, but it can be. How have you dealt with that?
Great question, Chris.
Yeah, you're talking about a situation where you're presenting to the client where they're angry and they want to go to the Supreme Court and you've got to break the news that that costs $250,000 and the thing is only worth $100,000.
No, I'm talking about a situation where we've decided up front what it's, we've entered into this agreement. And then some point at mediation or whatever, the other side makes an offer, which is reasonable in light of the context of the case, et cetera. But there is no incentive but there's no additional cost to the client to go forward and take a shot at trial,
I see what you're saying. Are you suggesting that in this case the client's motivation would be to continue out of an emotional desire to continue?
Well, it could be an emotional, it could be financial. What I'm focusing on the other, there's less incentive to end the case and resolve it than there would be if there were continuing costs.
Hey, I got it. Good, that's a great question. There's some nuance in the question, so I want to make sure I get it, but I really love the question. That does happen. Generally, you try and get in a meeting of the minds and an understanding of what you know, the emotion, instead of, I use to help price. I mean, what are they getting at? Do they really want to get more money and that's their motivation? You set the boundaries in your fixed price agreement right up front, and you can determine that if you get an offer that's acceptable and you can define that in dollar amounts early on, that you'll get a kicker or that the case would end or that they would accept it. Now, they don't have to, but that it would trigger a change order if it went beyond that. So I think that as professionals, we need to define the success because we know better and we're not emotional about the whole thing. So that if they want to continue out of emotion, they can. But the great thing is you can get paid for that. So I think we have to identify how driven they are by the emotion of the circumstance. And just in the original agreement, capture that and define an end to your scope, so that an emotional desire to continue triggers a change order.
This is Victoria in Dallas. I have a question. What are the implications of this whole model for work that's been traditionally done as contingent fee?
That's also a great question. If you're doing plaintiff's work, and a lot of it is statutory, what you're allowed to charge in terms of referral fees, anywhere from a third to 40%. We do a combination of fixed and contingency, or often fixed fee and reverse contingency, to align the incentives. And
can you describe that?
Yeah, like a reverse contingency fee.
Sure.
Let's say you want to minimize the risk. You want to price on value. You don't want to. You want to show your commitment to getting the value to the client. So what we'll do is we'll charge for half of the value as a fixed fee. Sometimes you can do a payment plan because litigation goes over a period of time, plus a reverse contingency where you would define the whole amount at issue. If you're doing defense representation, then, you know, it's a $250,000 case. And based on your assessment of liability and the cost to continue, that if you resolve the matter for less than $200,000, you'll get 50% of the difference that you save them.
So like a bonus of sorts.
Yeah, a bonus. And now you can structure your bonuses both in based on settlement amount and based in time. So if there are structural limitations on contingency based on outcome, a contingency that is in addition to that, that is time-bound, not time as in how many hours you put in, but certainly as in getting a desired resolution faster, which they would value, it's a different value proposition, wouldn't run afoul of the statutes.
Okay, I have some idea. I have some idea of what you're suggesting.
Yeah, and there's, you know, you could do a contingency or a reverse contingency or a mix of the fixed fee in both. So, you know, I was just giving you an example of one thing that we did with a client in a litigation was, like I said, having a sort of a three-tier structure of a value price, and then some of that where we had success kickers for time and for outcome.
We're approaching the time on this call towards the close of it. I'm curious, Ron or Chris, if you could talk a little bit. I mentioned earlier that you're going to spend time with 15 attorneys working specifically through this issue in a very customized way. And listen, gang, there's just a lot of us that are struggling with this, and it's just one of the things they want to do is help you work through that struggle and get it implemented finally in your practice. And I wondered, Ron, if you could say anything about what's going to happen at that workshop and what you intend for people.
Yeah, we structure the workshop as a day and a half. So we have found that if people have a chance to, because the first day is pretty intense, to sleep on this information, then they kind of come back the second day with a lot of questions and a lot of things are, you know, they get to acclimate a lot of this information. So the first day is going to be about not just the whys of value pricing, but also we're going to show them various checklists and various questions and walk them through kind of the mechanics of the value pricing and then give them, you know, some examples from Chris's firms and maybe others of actually how firms have implemented this and to really show them that this is just one big constant experiment. There's not one way to attack this. There are many ways. And then in the second day, the half day, we want them to come in with a particular client case or maybe a client they're trying to get and present their ideas about how they're going to approach the pricing of that engagement and present it to the group. And the group kind of acts at that point like a pricing cartel. If it was a bigger firm and you had a pricing cartel, you kind of go before that cartel with all the information on the client and the cartel kind of grills you with questions about, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? We had a client very similar, and we did this. And through this process, they will see that the more they think about it and the more minds they get together on it, the better they'll emerge from, you know, thinking about value. And that's kind of what this day, this workshop is structured around. And they'll get a flash drive of tools and other things that we're going to put and kind of walk them through as well to help them implement this.
And I assume there's a money-back guarantee.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we don't want to waste anybody's time. So if they don't get any value, then we only want them to pay for the value that they get. I mean, Chris and I absolutely walk our talk when it comes
well,
to that.
Well, and I will say the other, those of you that can make it or make it into that particular program, I think the other value is you're going to be sitting beside other attorneys like Lonnie, Mark Chin, and a few other people that are out on the front edge of this, along with Chris, that to see what they're doing and see how it actually applies to your practice and work through a model for your practice and finally get it done. And I'm suspicious those of you that are able to do this and will be interested to track results afterwards, they're going to see some dramatic improvements in revenue and especially profitability.
Hey, a lot of it, Mark, is just really getting the confidence to go stick their toe in the water.
Yeah.
We're not asking people to duck cannonball into the pool and do this all at once. We're asking them to try it gradually and build up confidence and build up some early successes and learn from every failure. But pricing is a skill. The more you do it, the better you get.
And, you know, one of the things that you've talked about in the past, but it's a scary thing for people to do when you start doing this. And I've done it myself, and I know I've heard a number of people talk about the first time that they actually have done it, the, you know, almost stutter that price out. And what a difference it makes when, you know, people accept it and you get moving with it.
Right.
So with that, I just want to acknowledge both of you. Chris, I want to acknowledge you for really being out there on the edge and being an innovator in this for the profession. And because everybody, you know, there's a number of people like you, Lonnie, Mark Chin, and a few others that are taking the leading edge on this. And you take a few knocks along the way when you do that. So thank you guys for taking the knocks that go along with leading a profession. And Ron, thank you just for your contribution and your continued brilliance in this area and your perseverance when, you know, we're so stuck in this issue. My experience with this is that even when we think we know what value pricing is, we have no idea what value pricing is. And that's what you're up against when you're leading us through these issues, I know. So I really thank you for making the time to lead the industry and for your mission in this work. So,
well, thank you, Mark. I mean, I have to say that just as an outsider, I mean, I'm obviously not an attorney, but the Atticus Group that I've spoken to in the past have been just a cut above the average, like compared to if I go speak to an ABA conference. So it's just a pleasure working with your people because they are more entrepreneurial.
And Mark, too, on my end, and thanks for that, my heart is with, like, everybody who's giving this a shot, and I really want so much to give everyone answers, and I was there at one point. And the philosophy that I have is really, we want to teach people to think. And it's not about selling people on the concept, it's just that I can give you one or two examples of how we do things, but ultimately, it's about taking some core principles of value pricing and thinking and applying them to your organization, because every factual situation is different, but in life, everything fits into, you know, some form of a core principle. And if we can give you the principles and how to apply them, that's really what it's about. So I know that it's hard in just three or four questions to get the answers out. But I'm hoping that in January we can get in a lot more detail.
Well, and those of you that are interested and can make it into Ron and Chris's workshop, if you go to the Atticus website, which is atticusonline.com, so www.atticusonline.com, and if you go to the seminars and workshops, and it'll bring up all the different seminars and workshops that are going on, but you go down to the bottom, that's the one that's the latest on the calendar is January, but if you go to the bottom, you'll see Ron and Chris's information. There's information on the workshop and then enroll. I will tell you that I'm pretty sure it'll be filled up pretty fast. So if you're interested in doing it, make a shot at that. With that, I'm going to go ahead and complete the call. Thanks, Chris and Ron and everyone else on the call. And Lonnie, thanks for your contribution. And Jack and everyone else, thanks for your questions.
Yes,
thank you, Mark.
Everyone.
Bye, everyone.